Every time this exhibition is mounted, we try to preserve a sense of punctuation in the path through the exhibition. And this is a room that we have treated like closing punctuation, really. And it's a work that is about a dialogue between artists who are peers, but also between a story of survival and a landscape whose representation has been largely fiction over the last century. And it's the only situation in the exhibition where we have brought in works from a public trust, so to speak, a collection that is not authored by Deanna, but for which Deanna's work can become a footnote or become another form of punctuation. Also works the other way too, right? Where we can't look now, knowing what we know about Barker Fairley's relationship to anti-blackness in Canada, we can't look at that petition and look at works by artists from the Group of Seven or of that ilk and not think about anti-blackness. Now, of course, we can see it in the work. We can see examples of a fictional representation of a landscape that is without people, largely, to preserve this notion of a space that can be colonized easily and without resistance. We can also see within that fiction a refusal to acknowledge the ways of life that precede the arrival of the folks who are interested in authoring that fiction. But one of the most, I think, singular works that Deanna has brought into the space is in the reproduction of an autobiography, really an autobiography of Sophia Pooley that appears in Benjamin Drew's book called The Fugitive, A Northside View of Slavery, which is important for a few reasons. It's the first publication anthology of first-person accounts of enslaved life in Canada, but it's also a narrative, especially this one, Sophia's narrative, is critical in showing us, revealing this tangle of relationships that exists between white settlers in Canada, enslaved and formerly enslaved black folks in Canada, and Indigenous people in Canada, all in so-called Canada. Deanna, there's also Archer's offering. There's a gift buried within all of this tangle of relationships. There's also a gift, and that's a song from Archer Pachawis. So, Deanna, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how you conceived that relationship between Sophia's narrative and Archer's drumming.
I want to say first and foremost, I want to speak to Archer first. Archer is probably the only person in the Canadian art world that knows me before art. So Archer knows me when I was a hot mess, nearly on the streets and acting like a fool. So Archer knows me from pre-consciousness, let's say. And he's been a central part of my practice. I call on him often. And so he's very much like a brother to me. His presence is often in my exhibition. I name him also because he's the first entry in the Other Places publication. And in that publication, it's a piece that he wrote to another Indigenous writer who mistakenly said that he was dead. And so, you know, he's had such an important and strong voice in the arts. He's been on his own path of healing, and I just love him in the same way that I deeply love and appreciate Charles. I like to have him around as much as I possibly can. And then Sophia Pooley was a slave that was purchased by Joseph Brant, Mohawk chief Joseph Brant, in the New York region where he also had a settlement of Mohawk people. So the thing about Joseph Brant is he was white and Indigenous, lived a dual life for his entire life. So when we think about Joseph Brant on Canadian soil, amongst the British, he functioned as a white man. And then, of course, on native land, he functioned as a Mohawk chief. Anybody that's familiar with the town of Brantford is named after Joseph Brant and that town, Joseph Brant's home. Much of that region is actually built by slaves that Joseph Brant owned. His home was built by 40 black slaves. He had wait staff. He had all kinds of black bodies in his servitude on Canadian soil. Sophia Pooley matters because, one, she tells the story of first her abduction by her first master, who was like a relative who stole her from the family or the patriarch that actually had bought her and brought her to a region and sold her to Joseph Brandt. So this is going to dispel the notion that somehow that Sophia Pooley just landed in the benevolent arms of a Mohawk chief. This is somebody that consciously bought that body, brought it to Canada along with other Black bodies purchased on the American side of the border and then put them to work here. But one other thing that she makes mention of, she talks about the fact that for most of her life, she was treated like his other children, a generally kind of positive experience until his third wife, who I guess developed some kind of concern or issue with her and refused to speak to her in a language she could understand. And then also ultimately went on to bludgeon her with an axe that created a very discernible mark on her face. Joseph Brandt decided to... Well, it's hard to determine through her testimony whether or not Joseph Brandt took pity on her and sold her off to a white family, or whether or not that was a strategy to deal with the marriage. I'm not really sure. But at the end of the day, Brandt sells her off to a white family by hat, which Crystal and I have gone on to do the work of discovering the descendant of that family who has known about the history but has not known how to deal with it. One. And two, it's super interesting because he's also another cultural worker in the arts. And so it's a super interesting thing to know that we can actually trace the experiences that Sophia Pooley had directly to a colleague of ours that is still very much living. I think one other thing I want to add to this is there's another testimony from John Francis who kind of reflects the other thing that we were talking about in another constellation about literacy. And John Francis talks about general kind of conditions of being there, but more specifically, he talks about the loss of land and the fact that white settlers are taking advantage of former slaves due to their inability to do math and language. So all of those things kind of give credence to what I've been speaking to in other areas. And when we think about cottage country, right, or we think of, say, the fact that Homer Watson comes from the Dune area, which is just around in that neck of the woods, that Lauren Harris was born in Brantford, you know, that all of these folks have a very clear and rich historical understanding of this region, and that they still choose to omit the bodies that were most prevalent on it, speaks to conscious consideration. This is not an accident. These are conscious choices that they're making in their compositions. It is important to flag the fact that characters like Massey, like Frank Oliver, like Mackenzie King, like Laurier, all of these people were part of the social network that the Group of Seven engaged with, either through blood or through industry, and that sensibility. And you also have to remember that all of these people are still staunch imperialists. And so their policies are all about the erasure of Black bodies. And there is, through other exhibitions that I've created, a very clear, traceable map of the decisions to use Canadian culture and this group of painters to shape a particular narrative of the nation. There simply is just no way to extract. You can't continue to extract the Group of Seven from history. It is such a critical thing to consider. And the fact that at this stage of the game, there has been such an extraordinary pushback to a complication of that narrative that, you know, it continues to give credence to the realities of the white supremacist foundation and ambitions of the Group of Seven's work.